So Kyle, your blog reminded me.
Immediately of, you know, a dozen experiences that I've had that are similar.
Of course.
And you and I have had kind of serendipitous overlapping musical experiences beyond just Pearl Jam. But
yeah,
one of the things that he mentions actually on 108 that gets me thinking as well is back to the whole 90s alternative music scene.
Butch Vig.
Yeah, he talks about Butch Vig, Steve Albini, and their kind of the ways that they're known as producers for producing a certain kind of sound on the records.
Kind of that Nirvana sound, the Smashing Pumpkin sound.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And, you know, it's, Brian Eno is actually really well known for this as well, and kind of as being the fifth member of Coldplay over the last several years and producing, helping Coldplay kind of blend into the background of any given situation, right? Because you can hear Coldplay anywhere. So it's interesting to me that, you know, whereas Butch Vig and Steve Albini are kind of more about bombast, you know.
Yeah.
Eno has been, and I think that Rickert writes about him in the book here, as being kind of a master of the background music.
And background music on purpose, right?
Exactly.
You know, I listened to a lot of classical music. I was a music major for a while in undergrad before it turned into a minor, and it was a very classically oriented program. And I still listen to most classical music in the background, stuff I'm not paying attention to. And yet I sometimes kind of imagine these composers kind of like looking over my shoulder saying like, hey, I didn't write this for you to have it on in the background. I wanted you to pay attention and know what the moves I was doing meant. And here's Brian Eno, the way that Rickert describes it, really fascinatingly, making music on purpose for you to listen to in the background.
Right, or as a part of kind of a environmental experience. I mean, of course, there's this whole chapter on the Microsoft boot up sound, which is fascinating because we've all heard it.
Yeah, the way Eno writes it out is boom, bling, tink, tink, tink.
That's right.
We should almost do it in harmony. It's a boom, bling, tink, tink, tink.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm sure we can insert the Microsoft sounds whenever we want, like here. You know, because of the magic of recording.
That's true.
Eno wants to set up an environment where you're surprised by the connections between the sound he makes and what that means to you and your environment. And he even wants to be surprised by that too. I love this idea that Rickert says Eno is simultaneously composer and audience. He's actant and recipient all at the same time.
Yeah, and he invites us to participate along with that as well. What does this have to do with ambient rhetoric?
Well, I think this fits into everything we've been saying earlier about decentering the human agent, attuning ourselves, and I'm using the word attune pretty purposely. It's a Rickert word. Attuning ourselves to the ways that all of the ambient features of an environment, the affect, the material, the emotional, the cultural, the historical, all of that are all part of what governs what can be communicated, said, experienced in that moment. And I think ambient music in the Brian Eno tradition, it kind of draws attention to that. It says, hey, there's more to this experience right now than just what I'm sending you. You have to pay attention to the rest because I'm purposely asking you to pay attention to the rest.
Yeah, and I agree there, although I was going to play devil's advocate and ask, you know, in these particular cases, well, aren't they all still composed, right? Mm. Doesn't Butch Vig and Steve Albini and Brian Eno all have a very specific way of going about producing the kinds of, you know, of sounds that they're interested in very controlled environments, you know? And then I was reminded, I don't know if this completely answers the question, but a couple of years ago, right when iPhones kind of hit the market, or maybe a couple of years after, Eno produced an iPhone app called Bloom. I'm just reading from Wikipedia here. The software plays a low drone, and touching the screen produces different tones, which play in a loop.
Yeah.
If the screen is left untouched, the software will create its own music. Just this really interesting, user-generated music that relies on kind of a framework that Eno built, but he leaves it in the hands of the user to actually produce the sound.
And isn't that the nature of any kind of so-called interactive experience? You know, I'm thinking of Second Life or something. There's so much opportunity for me to step in there and in an interactive way make new things in the way that I want. But it's still within the parameters of the of the creator. And part of me wonders if Rickert would say that that is what any rhetorical situation is like, that we're always within parameters. We're always within the parameters of the choric, chirotic situation that has been given to us, sometimes even more than we think we are. Let me also add that one reason the Eno stuff was so intriguing for my work was because I'm really interested in the historical ways people have understood music and rhetoric. And I find that when you look at kind of this European history, you know, going back to the 15, 1600s of people applying what they knew about rhetoric then to musical composition, I feel like the results always feel unsatisfactory to me as a rhetorical scholar. There's always kind of this overly simplistic application of a rhetorical term to music, and it always seems like now I use this figure of rhetoric, so therefore it was rhetoric, and therefore that's what rhetoric is. It's just applying figures and understanding the figures. Ha ha, we're done. And so I've been in search for a while now of what, how do I put into words, you know, this, what the complex contemporary ways we understand rhetoric, right?
Sure.
And so I think that when I read Rickert, especially in these chapters 3 and 4, where he starts bringing up Eno, I start thinking, this is it. There's something here about reminding us that persuasion is still part of rhetoric, but it's bigger. It's intensified, like we mentioned earlier. Rickert says we have to include more than just what these old theories thought. And that helps me a lot. It's really, really intriguing.
I'm going to take us on another tangent. So one of the concepts that I think is really interesting about that Rickert brings up over and over again is this reliance that traditional rhetoric has had on this notion of symbolicity. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about, again, that's this idea of these producers, Steve Albini and Butch Vig, and the ways that their job is to produce kind of almost like a symbolic reflection of what the band sounds like. You get this idea of what, for example, the Smashing Pumpkins sound like live.
Yeah.
Billy Corgan's voice is banshee-like. There's a certain affect that you get, you know, kind of get accustomed to seeing them live. That almost completely disappears, especially on the kind of famous Butch Vig production, Siamese Dream, where you get this very clean, very melodic. Siamese Dream is kind of known for its overproduction.
Yeah, I remember being on Smashing Pumpkins' listserv in the mid-90s, and one of the questions going around was, what color do you associate with each album? You know, because that's what we talked about. And I remember the prevailing answer with Siamese Dream was silver. It was metallic. It's been overproduced to that level of perfection.
Right.
And by the way, it's my favorite album of ever.
Wow. It's up there for me too. Really, it really is. That disparity between the production quality, you know, album and then seeing them live. Even like they've been putting out, you know, these albums again, and one of the things that they often will come with are these, like, you know, extensive alternative takes and that kind of thing. And what you start to realize is that a certain song, say Today by Smashing Pumpkins, to take a well-known example, has achieved a certain iconic symbolic status in our minds that even slight differences in, you know, that experience are jarring, right?
Yeah.
And there's something, I think that there's something interesting there related to the ways that symbolicity as rhetoric kind of ends up maybe blocking or hiding some of what's actually present, what's kind of behind the production curtain.
What this is reminding me of when you're talking about the meaning beyond the symbolicity is it's making me think about some of Rickert's reliance on Heidegger and this idea that the interesting quote from Rickert, riffing off of Heidegger, is that we do not add meaning downstream. Our experience is one where something is always already interpreted as something. I'm still quoting here. In other words, what we do is always in the form of historically enculturated practices, most of which remain tacit or ambient in our everyday doings. That's on page 172. So I'm thinking about that Smashing Pumpkins sound, whether it's live or whether it's listening to Siamese Dream, and how my reaction to it, or the way it changes me, or the way it moves me in some way, whether it's emotional, but it's more than emotional, right? That is something that hits me in a moment. It all comes to me, and I don't stop and think, oh, that that's an interesting sound there. I wonder how they got that drum sound, or I wonder how they did the guitar. Is that five guitars overlaid of each other, or is that 15 at that moment? And sure, I can stop and think that, but the immediacy of it comes before that. There's something that's straight ahead and right away. And that's something we've talked a little bit about before, trying to wrap our heads around how that concept of the totality of meaning, that Heideggerian, the message hits us. It's ontologically present in the world, but also we make sense of it phenomenologically, and what that has to do with being rhetoric.